From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update on the situation in Syria.
We don't want our people to leave the country. We want them to come back. Stop the support for the terrorism. Stop the economic sanctions. Stop the Turkish, Jordanian, Qatari intervention in our internal efforts. Stop training the so-called moderate terrorist opposition. Then the situation will be amenable to a political settlement. And the Syrian government is open to such a discourse.
That was the permanent representative of the Syrian Arab Republic, Bashar Ja'afari, speaking at the UN Security Council Wednesday, as he amplified and supplemented the report on conditions in his country presented to the Council by Stephen O'Brien, Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator. O'Brien urged Council members to set aside their differences to finally bring an end to the ongoing nightmare in Syria. We bring you the statements of both Ambassador Ja'afari and Undersecretary O'Brien in their entirety.
The recent images of the 3-year-old boy, Aylin Kurdi, lying lifeless on a beach in Turkey, encapsulates the profound and prolonged desperation of the Syrian people, too long exposed to the horrors of a brutal and savage conflict. I recount the words of Abdullah Kurdi, Aylin's father, who said, and I quote, "I tried to catch my children and my wife, but there was no hope. One by one, they died." Tragically, far too many Syrian families have spoken similar words over the last 5 years. It is civilians who continue to bear the brunt of this war. As the plight of Syrian refugees desperately trying to reach Europe in recent weeks has shown, the effects of the Syria crisis are not just national or regional, but global in nature. The conflict in Syria has propelled one of the largest refugee exodus since the Second World War. These refugees are fleeing for their lives from war and violence and have a right to seek asylum without any form of discrimination. As an international community, it is our responsibility to support the neighbouring countries who shoulder most of the burden. At the same time, stronger efforts must be made to address the root causes that force people to leave their homes and seek asylum abroad, addressing the flee or die response natural to each and every one of us faced with peril or a challenge to our survival. For Syria, it should be clear to all that this means a political settlement that brings an end to the crisis. So, Mr. President, in the absence of such a political solution, this Council passed Resolution 2139 in February 2014, which demanded action by the parties in a number of areas, including an end to attacks against civilians and civilian infrastructure, and facilitating unhindered humanitarian access. I deeply regret to inform the Council that some 18 months later, the Council's strong demands continue to go unheeded. By any measure, human suffering in Syria has worsened, not diminished. Over the past month, violence has continued throughout the country. There has been no reduction in the appalling patterns of violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law. Indiscriminate attacks, including with explosive weapons, continue to cause widespread death and destruction. For example, between the 17th and 26th August, government forces repeatedly attacked residential areas in Douma, rural Damascus, killing at least 90 civilians and wounding nearly 300 more. Meanwhile, in the last week of August, non-state armed groups launched hundreds of shells on civilian populated areas of Damascus and rural Damascus, killing at least 20 civilians and injuring many more. While yesterday, shelling by non-state armed groups on civilian populated areas of Aleppo killed at least 33 people, including women and children, and injured over 150 more people. Allegations of attacks with chemical agents continue to be received. The joint OPCW UN mechanism, established by Security Council Resolution 2235 of 2015, is the relevant body to investigate these allegations. Now, Mr. President, the deliberate targeting of civilian infrastructure continues to occur with alarming frequency. Attacks by non-state armed groups have resulted in significant disruption to municipal water and electricity networks in Aleppo, Damascus and Daraa over the past weeks and months. Most recently, some 2 million people were without water in Aleppo City for 2 weeks in August. Deliberately depriving families and communities of water and electricity only serves to worsen humanitarian conditions and drive ordinary Syrians into greater despair and desperation. Hospitals and medical facilities continue to be attacked. In August, Physicians for Human Rights documented 12 attacks on medical facilities, while 15 medical workers were killed. Since the start of 2014, there have been 169 attacks on medical facilities and 252 medical workers have been killed. Attacks on such facilities have had a multiplier effect, not only killing and injuring, but also destroying the healthcare system as a whole, leaving many Syrians unable to obtain the most basic levels of care. Schools, which should be safe places for children to learn and grow, continue to be attacked. Since the start of 2014, the United Nations has verified at least 84 attacks on or near schools, although the actual number of schools attacked is likely to be higher. One in four schools cannot be used because they have been damaged, destroyed, or are being used as shelters for the internally displaced or for military purposes. Deliberate attacks on hospitals and schools are war crimes. All parties will, unquestionably, be held to account now and however far into the future it takes after investigation and due judicial process. Mr. President, I've spoken before about the impact of the conflict on Syria's children and young people, but it does bear repeating once again. Today, Syria is one of the most dangerous places on earth to be a child. Over 5.6 million children are in need of immediate assistance. Although the school year commenced this past week, over 2 million children, that's one out of every three, are not in school in Syria, and an additional 450,000 children are at risk of dropping out. We are extremely concerned about hundreds of thousands of children in ISIL-controlled areas forced to follow a curriculum designed by the designated terrorist group. According to reports by the Commission of Inquiry and others, children are murdered, tortured, and subjected to sexual violence by all parties to the conflict. Millions of children have been traumatized by the horrors they have witnessed. Young people have few prospects. The conflict is not only destroying Syria's present, but it is also destroying its future. One missing cohort of educated young people will soon become two cohorts. Mr. President, despite the volatile and insecure environment, the United Nations and NGO partners continue to deliver life-saving assistance to millions of people in need. In the past month alone, 4.2 million people received food aid. Medicines and supplies for 1.1 million treatments were dispatched, and nearly 450,000 received relief items and other support. We should all recognize the commitment and bravery of the thousands of workers who deliver much-needed aid at great personal risk, particularly Syrian organizations and volunteers who are often the first responders on the front lines. While we are reaching a significant number of people, we are still unable to deliver sufficient quantities of aid to people in the hardest-to-reach areas. Fighting and insecurity hamper our ability to respond. For example, during August, the World Food Programme was unable to reach over 1 million people in rural Damascus, rural Homs, and rural Hama. A further 750,000 people in ISIL-controlled areas cannot be reached with food due to safety concerns. In addition to insecurity, the parties to the conflict continue to place restrictions that limit or obstruct where, to whom, and how often we deliver assistance. Some 422,000 people continue to live under the most intolerable siege conditions, unable to leave their communities, and we are largely unable to get in to deliver much-needed humanitarian assistance. Over the last 3 months, only 9% of people in besieged areas per month have received much-needed health assistance from the United Nations, while no food or other basic relief supplies have entered these areas, despite the overwhelming need. Approval for 46 requests for interagency convoys remains pending with the government of Syria. If approved, the United Nations could reach an additional 1.2 million people in desperate need of assistance. Meanwhile, government-approved convoys to Nubul, Zara, Afrin in Aleppo, and to Foa and Kafraya in Idlib have been stalled by the lack of approval by non-state armed groups for safe passage. There can be no justification for deliberately obstructing humanitarian access and depriving civilians of access to services essential to their survival. On a more positive note, I welcome the recent progress on the visas in August, with the government of Syria granting 109 visas for United Nations staff members from 12 different offices. 96% of the visa applications submitted in August were approved during the same month. I very much hope this trend will continue, not only with the visas, but also for other administrative obstacles. And Mr. President, the lack of funding for humanitarian operations continues to be a major challenge. We require some $738 million to fund essential life-saving operations until the end of this calendar year in Syria. I appreciate the generosity of donors in 2015 already and ask them to consider making additional pledges given the extraordinary level of need we are facing. And Mr. President, we are running out of words to describe the utter disregard for human life and dignity that has become the hallmark of this crisis. Every day that passes, more Syrian children, women and men die. Millions more are forced to live in appalling conditions where there is no safe refuge in their country, where their basic needs for protection are unmet, where their fundamental rights are trampled upon, and where their futures and that of their country appear increasingly bleak. While the parties to this conflict are responsible for upholding their obligations under international law, the members of the Security Council and other member states with influence can and must do more to demand that the indiscriminate violence stops, that sieges are lifted, that civilian infrastructure is respected, and that vital humanitarian assistance reaches all areas of the country without delay. But above all else, this Council must focus its efforts on finding a political solution. I call again on this Council to set aside their differences and to work together to bring an end to this nightmare for the Syrian people. As bestowed by the UN Charter, the Security Council has an inescapable responsibility to help the Syrian people realise a future of peace. I very much hope that, for the sake of the people of Syria, a political solution is found as soon as possible. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank Mr. O'Brien for his briefing. Distinguished colleagues, during this meeting, we had a request on a statement from the permanent representative of the Syrian Arab Republic. Now, if there is no objection to that, as president of the Security Council, I would like to invite the representative of the Syrian Arab Republic to take part in the meeting. And if there are no objections, it is so decided.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would like to thank the Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Mr. O'Brien, for his briefing, which he has just presented to the distinguished members of the Security Council. In the light of this brief, very important briefing presented by Mr. O'Brien, I would like to share with you my views regarding certain important aspects. First, Mr. O'Brien was right in saying that the root causes for the Syria crisis must be addressed, and they are naturally political and not humanitarian. Therefore, I will proceed from this important statement that he made. Here, I'm not in the I'm not in the intending to criticize the report by the Secretary General or make observations on the statement by the Under Secretary General. Rather, I would like to clarify the comprehensive picture that is the framework for the humanitarian situation in my country, Syria. As you know, gentlemen, this August Council adopted a series of important resolutions to combat terrorism. The Russian presidency, to its credit, organized 2 days ago an important event on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of the adoption of Resolution 1624. Resolution 1624 was followed by Resolution 1989, then Resolution 2199, all of which are resolutions that prohibit instigating terrorism, funding terrorism, and assisting terrorism. But above all else, they are resolutions that make it mandatory on the states members of the United Nations not to adopt terrorism as a policy to pressure the governments of some member states. This statement, theoretically, is splendid, but practically is not applied at all. In northern Syria, there are armed terrorist groups outside the law. They are called the Army of the Fatah, Army of the Conquest, financed by Turkey and Qatar. This armed group called the Jaish al-Fatah, the Army of the Conquest, every day fires thousands of shells on our folks in Aleppo, killing hundreds and injuring thousands, and preventing the normal life. In the south, there is another terrorist army funded by Saudi Arabia and Jordan, which is a member of this Jordan of this council and a sister and a fraternal country neighboring Syria. This army perpetrates the same dirty terrorist tactics targeting our folks in southern Syria in the same way. Then there is another army of terrorists working in the suburbs of Damascus in a town called Douma, which Mr. O'Brien touched upon. A group of terrorists funded by Saudi Arabia and who call themselves the Army of Islam, Jaish al-Islam. Thus, in 1 minute, I have mentioned terrorists who comprise three armies, one working under Turkey's command, the other under Jordan's command, and the third under Saudi Arabia and Qatar's command. In 1 minute, I have briefly presented the picture. Unfortunately, the report by the Secretary General calls these terrorist groups as armed, non-state armed groups, does not call them terrorist groups, rather calls them non-state armed groups. As you know, this is a neutral, very neutral expression, which totally is not in conformity with the provisions of your resolutions relevant to combating terrorism. Therefore, the question is political par excellence, and that has led to the deterioration of the humanitarian situation, part of which has manifested in the exodus of the refugees, which Mr. O'Brien mentioned, which has become the main preoccupation of world public opinion and the international media. The tragedy of my people in Syria is a major tragedy. Unfortunately, so far in this August Council, we have not yet touched upon the real cause which is causing segments of the Syrian people to leave their countries, to leave their country by force. Terrorism, gentlemen, is the main reason for the fleeing of these multitudes of Syrians from their country. Terrorism first, and the so-called unilateral coercive economic sanctions, or as misnamed economic sanctions imposed on the Syrian people. These also are a major reason for paralyzing the economic life and the destruction of the infrastructure and the closing down of hundreds, if not thousands, of factories and the elimination of employment opportunities and increasing of unemployment. This is also another reason for the crisis in my country. The third reason is this: the bringing in this huge wave of terrorists and mercenaries from all over the world. Terrorists coming from 100 states, members of this international organization, Australia, America, Britain, France, Belgium, France, Libya, Tunisia, Saudi Arabia, Emirates, Qatar, etc. This is one of your reports. You designated this number and you said there are terrorists and mercenaries that are coming from 100 states, counting in the thousands, who are destroying Syrian archaeological artifacts and in Syria and Iraq, killing and taking captive women in Syria, smuggling archaeological facts and oil and gas through Turkish brokers to the European Union. This funds terrorism. Syrian antiquities are sold in auctions in London. How did such antiquities get to London? Syrian and Iraqi oil and gas are sold through Turkish brokers. The photograph of the child Elan has rendered a great service to the Syrian people. This picture has rendered a major service because it allowed highlighting certain aspects that were not addressed by the media or politicians or diplomats. How come children do not go to school? Now the picture is clear. They do not go to school because terrorists control a very large number of areas where schools are located, and they deprive children from attending these schools. And also formulate terrorist curricula inspired by Saudi and Gulf curricula to teach our children beheading and hatred of other religions and hatred of all others who see things differently. Has ISIS come from a vacuum? No. There are those who have sponsored ISIS, helped ISIS, funded ISIS, and facilitated its smuggling of oil, gas, and antiquities abroad, outside Syria and Iraq. Still, some are still going around in a vicious circle whose only preoccupation is slandering the Syrian government, the Syrian president, and the Syrian army. So, to the point that one delegate called for a Arya formula meeting to speak about two gay people, a Syrian and an Iraqi, as if this were the preoccupation of the council, rather than settling the Syrian crisis politically in an operation led by Syrians without external intervention, in accordance with your decisions, with your resolutions. Today, I sent to His Excellency the President of the Council a series of letters. The first is the reply by the Syrian government to the 19th report of the Secretary General on the implementation of Resolution 2139, 2165, and 2191. I also sent a group of other letters regarding the number of victims who fell in Aleppo and Damascus as a result of the shelling by non-state groups, as called by the security, by the Secretary General, those terrorist armies that I mentioned, funded by Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. Hundreds of victims in Aleppo and Damascus. By name, this we have all this submitted to your attention over the past years. This scenario is still unfolding while some are ignoring it and still call these terrorists non-state armed groups. The speaker repeats, non-state armed groups. Why is Syria only designated for this nomenclature? Why come? How come the only the terrorists in Syria and Iraq is called non-state actors? If there is a terrorist in the U.S., he's called a terrorist. If a terrorist appears in France, he's called a terrorist. In Spain, Belgium, and Britain, he's called a terrorist. But why isn't he called a terrorist in Syria? Why there is a cover-up, and why his actions are justified, and why such terrorists are called non-state armed groups? The legitimate Syrian government is a legitimate government whose duty is to protect its people, implement the constitution, and combat terrorism. But we cannot do this on our own. We need your support, your assistance, and your understanding of the magnitude of the terrorist threat we're facing in Syria, Iraq, and the region. And it's a threat that is beginning to reach your countries. I sincerely hope that the Syrian crisis will be addressed away from interventionist political agendas of some governments, including some members of the Security Council. The agony of the Syrian people has increased enough. Our agonies are not up for sale. We are not in a bazaar for immoral business, trafficking in the agony of our people. We want our people to leave the country. We want them to come back. Stop the support for the terrorism. Stop the economic sanctions. Stop the Turkish, Jordanian, Qatari intervention in our internal efforts. Stop training the so-called moderate terrorist opposition. Then the situation will be amenable to a political settlement. And the Syrian government is open to such a discourse. It is open to coming to an understanding with the national opposition in Syria, not with terrorism. Not with terrorism. You yourselves do not accept to have a dialogue with terrorists. One final time, our agony is great. Our pains are great. Our sorrow is great. As a result of foreign intervention in our internal affairs and because of misleading political readings of the situation in Syria. When there is a cover-up of the actions by ISIS and al-Nusra Front and Jaish al-Fatah and Jaish al-Islam and all these terrorist gangs, this means that their actions are legitimate. And that there are countries that are protecting them. Therefore, they persist in their terrorism. But while we need the actual implementation of the initiative presented by President Putin by establishing an actual effective international coalition against terrorism. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the representative of the Syrian Arab Republic for that statement.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.